they're linked in sensibility, but they're physically, one is set off the other.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love is, I mean, all of that is rooted in a purpose as well. You know, simple fact that wood wants to stay dry.
Right.
You know, so you hold it off the ground, you know, but in doing so, now you have an attitude about the site. Successful projects have a kind of marrying of these different aspects that we're talking about. It serves a functional purpose and expresses a kind of poetic attitude about respecting the site, the nature, letting the nature flow right under the building.
Welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. Today we have Tom Lane, an architect at Witten Architecture based in Portland, Maine. Tom received a Bachelor of Fine Art from University of Massachusetts Amherst and a Master of Architecture from the University of Utah, where he was awarded the school's highest design honor. As an author and illustrator, Tom's work is published in the Architect's Guidebook to Structures textbook. That's pretty cool. He has been a design critic at the University of Utah and the University of Maine at Augusta. That would be pretty fun, design critic. I've often kind of thought I'd like to do that. But
I think you really should.
Our interview today is sponsored by Maine Home Design. Don't miss AIA Design Theory in the upcoming August issue. Tom's AIA Design Theory in the upcoming August issue of Maine Home Design. Thank you again for coming into the studio today, Tom Lane.
Thank you for having me, Trent.
Absolutely. We got talking a while back on, we're out in the Roque Bluffs area.
That's right.
And I remember we got kind of into it and I was like, oh, we got to save these kind of conversations and get them on camera sometime. That'd be great.
That's right. I can't believe how long ago that was now, but it's 2 years ago this summer, I think.
Was it? Yeah.
We were shooting a project and we took a break for lunch, I think, and started talking about, I don't know.
Design theory and belief and as it all relates and everything else. And to me, it's all interesting because there's that, for one, there's a large degree of need for creativity and imagination when you're envisioning what lies out potentially outside of this world or not. And when you're designing something, you're also creating and using that to inform what actually happens. And so that's always been a very interesting how those things cross-pollinate for me.
Mm-hmm.
And both you and I come from backgrounds or belief systems that are essentially Christianity with added sprinkles. How do you feel that believing in an outside higher power consciousness, if you will, actually does translate into what you design, how you design, and how you approach design?
I think it's an interesting question, and relative to trying to let the architecture be derivative of a particular place, There's sort of two things that we're talking about. We're talking about kind of universal things, and we're talking about specific things.
Right, you know? Kind of your belief of the universal and how it comes into the specific.
And how it relates, how it manifests into a specific work in a specific place.
Right, and to me, I find interest in, does it actually affect that? And could you see a difference somehow between someone who held belief of an outside consciousness compared to someone who did not believe of an outside consciousness, but maybe approached the same problem, but did it differently?
I think it has a little bit to do with just being open, approaching a problem from an open standpoint or even a humble standpoint.
Okay.
That I'm not bringing all the answers to this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming with a question.
Right.
I'm approaching a place or a site or a architectural design problem with questions, not answers. So it's a little bit more of an approach that says that I don't have all the answers. I'm someone who's seeking, and I want to find out what this place has to tell me.
Right. That's interesting because I would imagine in my both in my both atheist mind and believer mind that now are much more active in my head, mm-hmm. they are both equally humbled in mm-hmm. that, and both kind of have that same approach that going into any situation, I have to pull from my experiences and how they overlay on what I believe. Mm-hmm. And there's a quality to my judgment that comes from hashing out belief and experience that, you know, produces cognitive dissonance at points, and you work those out.
Right.
And then you come to a new situation, a new problem that mm-hmm. maybe it's a design problem, and you approach it with humbleness in that there's, in my opinion, no way of encapsulating an idea of something beyond that would give you absolute answers that you could then solve problems with to that degree of specificness.
Right.
And then the atheist mind to me as well would come to that in the same way of saying this is a vast mystery that still requires so many questions.
Right.
And I was just speaking with someone the other day who, you know, it felt like no matter the, there'd be outliers like extreme fundamentalists on either side of a belief spectrum that mm-hmm. would maybe bring that personality to a problem that they're approaching. But I felt like the intentionality mm-hmm. of someone who's saying, I'm considering the beyond and how that influences my day-to-day actions on either side, no matter atheist or whatever, the intentionality being there creates a person that's more actively processing and intentional about what they're doing. And to me, it seems like they produce the same end results. And I'd have a difficult time saying this person with the solution came from a belief process that informed that compared to a non-belief process. And I'm already losing and confusing myself in that, but
I think to kind of engage with that, with your line of thinking there, you know, I think you mentioned sort of fundamentalism, and there's an aspect of that which kind of feels like it knows the answer, you know?
Yeah.
So, and which is kind of a closed position,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so relative to approaching a design solution, I like to think that it's a more interesting open process to approach it rather than saying, I know the answer before we get there, before we start the design problem, because I adhere to these principles.
Mm.
I'd rather say that, you know, I...
Well, fundamentalists, I'd say yeah. They almost bring laws mm-hmm. rather than principles.
I think that's true. I think so that's sort of, that's an approach to life probably. I mean, that's,
right.
you know, that can apply to your kind of spiritual side or not.
Right.
But I think a kind of mature approach to belief in your place in the kind of universe, because, you know, that's what we're talking about a little bit. A mature approach to that leads to humility, because you realize that there's only a few things that you're certain of, you know, and this kind of universal aspect that we're talking about, I find is interesting, but I'm more interested in the specific. And in the particular, and in grounding that whole conversation into something that is physical and in front of us that we mm-hmm. can touch, you know, a you know, some moss on a stone, on a site that you mm-hmm. that when you arrive there, there's something about that specific experience that brings out the kind of spirit of a place,
right?
That there's a you know, being open to what that specific experience tells you spiritually is is interesting to me from a design as
now,
a designer.
When you approach, and this is a great segue into actually what you're writing on in your design theory article, and is very interesting. Now, when you approach a site, do you feel that there is truly something other than simply matter with quantum and electrical connections that we observe? Do you feel that there's actually more there that communicates like a spirit of place to you to some degree?
You know, I think that, I think we as human beings, you know, have feelings, emotions, imagination that overlays our direct experience of floors, walls, ceiling, light.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, that's sort of what poetry is about. That's what art is about, is about bringing out that sort of aspect of the physical world.
Right.
What, like you said, sort of atoms,
kind of
electrons.
An X factor that you absorb from experience
right.
in any place, any person,
right.
any place, any situation. There's something, there's an impression that you're left with that later you may have another experience and there might be a flavor of that in that, and it's a reminder of it or,
Right, so music, you know, is notes and chords, but it's a, you know, we hear a song and that's something different to us as human beings, right? So a place is like, you know, atoms, things that we can measure. But there's an aspect that we can't measure, and that's the poetic aspect that is kind of a rich source to draw on. It requires a little bit of a different lens.
Inspiration and
yeah.
There has to be a sensitivity and an openness to perception of that experience that as a good artist, architect, and so on, you're able to pull that in. Well, especially as an architect, because you're not simply communicating your voice into art. You're taking a place and you're taking a client's programmatic issues that they need solved and their experience of that place and everything else and their desires. And you're translating and you're connecting. You're like a technician and an artist and a communicator and a, you know, psychologist all at once, kind of.
Yeah, it's different hats or different lenses, or you know, there's different ways to solve a kind of problem holistically.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as an architect, especially designing someone's home, you're asked to kind of bring your whole person, your whole experience to that design problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not designing, you're not solving the problem from a function standpoint. Or a you know, thermal envelope standpoint on its own.
Right.
You're also creating an experience that someone's going to live there and create memories there, and their children will be there,
right.
And they'll be there in summer, they'll be there in winter, and there's an aspect of that makes it richer and makes it kind of poetic. So you have to be open to that.
Mm. Yeah, that kind of gives me goosebumps to put all that together and to hear it in that manner. And it's interesting to see the very intentionally and knowingly humble approach to that while practicing a religious belief practice. And that sounds kind of like an insult, like I'm expecting you to be closed-minded because you practice religion. And that comes from my own baggage of that I'm working through. So don't take that personally.
Sure.
But
no. Yeah,
that's encouraging and inspirational to me to interact with someone who is humble and open and working creatively and producing something of value and being open to that. And that's, Yeah, we're just working through my issues here, so let's get back.
You have this platform for that purpose.
So. Yeah, maybe a lot of other people have similar issues as me in some way. I don't know, but you've thought about it, and it's interesting. It's hard for me to find someone who's thought as much about what they believe and how it connects to what they do and how they serve others in a design format like that, and is able to verbalize it.
Yeah.
It's not, people do it really well,
yeah,
but they might not be able to articulate it to the level and the depth that you are.
I consider it something like, I don't personally have all the answers. I'm a participant. I'm a, I'm a questioner, and I'm on a journey that we're all on,
mm-hmm.
In this experience.
Right.
And I think it's interesting that in our work, together with my colleagues at Witten Architects, we get to tap into these kind of poetic moments and draw them out, because, this kind of our experience in the universe is a little bit too broad, but our experience in this room with these objects, with these other people, is specific and can be very meaningful, and can, I think, open our eyes to what those other broader things might be.
How much time do you spend considering on a daily basis? How much time do you spend considering your meaning and place in the universe? And how much do you think that directly influences your effectiveness as a designer?
It's a bit of a hard question. I think these things in our experience as human beings are not separate, right? These things are overlaid, what I mean? Especially working from home.
Right. Yeah,
because you're.
Honey, can you reach us at the top cabinet?
Yeah, and it's you're in my case, I have two daughters. You know what I mean? And they're I interact with them much more on a daily basis now. And for me, they're my door to a broader universe. And a deeper meaning to all of the things that we do on a daily basis. So, it's. I don't know that I'm conscious of that effect. That might be for someone else to say, looking at the way I work. But
speaking of the influence that we have on others through the interesting thing, kind of a side note, the influence that we have on others in a way of comparing them as far as how you relate to people compared to what you maybe like when I look at my kids, it's very interesting to me that at the end of the day, if I'm only telling them what to do or not do, they'll be bucking against that by the end of the day. But if I model it and I'm present with them all day, at the end of the day, there's just hugs, good feelings, and well-behaved children who've caught, who they need to be from me rather than being told.
Right.
And that ability to know that and to use it to make yourself be present and be able to hear people, to be able to hear clients and work with them effectively. I think if a person has that mindset of relationship is so key here rather than a list of do's and don'ts or whatever.
So you're talking again about, principles versus experience, there's principle in instruction that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's not presented,
law instruction.
Okay.
To me, principles are more, not ambiguous, but they're not delineated lines as much as guiding principles.
Sure.
But like what you're saying to me right now, I view as like laws,
okay,
like do's and don'ts.
Yep, right. So there's a presentation of law, in a certain way. And there's a presentation of it with basically love, which
right.
is different. And so this kind of, you know, open approach to experience, I think just makes life a little more interesting, artistic, poetic. You know, we have an opportunity to stop and appreciate the things that are around us rather than kind of be in conflict mm-hmm. with them. And that's part of the theory that, you know, I'm putting forward, which isn't my personal theory. I mean, this is a theory that I read about as a student. Christian Norberg Schultz is a Norwegian architect, author, theorist,
mm-hmm.
who puts forward this idea of the spirit of a place. Mm-hmm. You know, genius loci is what he calls it, and that kind of concept, you know, sounded kind of exotic and mysterious to me, you know, as a student, and still does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe why I like it. I like revisiting it because it has a kind of richness, and it opens up your thinking after you've tried to solve a problem in a very pragmatic way.
Right. So I see that as that ability to maintain openness in your approach to solving design problems
mm-hmm.
would be like having a tractor that you're using that breaks down, you fix it, it gets scratched, you use it, it breaks, you're fixing it. And, you know, over time that tractor does so much and looks like it's done so much and it has been useful compared to a tractor that you keep in the garage and it's perfect
mm-hmm.
and you only use it to do very exact occasional things. Like if you mm-hmm. had, instead of, Loki, the name, term?
Genius Loki.
Genius Loki. Instead of an approach like that, if you had more of a, say, rigid, all right, it's classical architecture for me mm-hmm. and we use the golden ratio and that's it,
mm-hmm.
you know? That is an approach, and it has been proven to produce buildings that are kept around.
Right.
But it doesn't leave an openness to everything that you might find an upgrade to certain things or
right.
an improvement upon certain things.
I think even with that approach, in great, you know, works of architecture, regardless of their kind of style, if they express that kind of, if that spirit of that place is kind of manifest through them, you know, I'm thinking mm-hmm. great works, you know, the Pantheon or something, you know.
Have you been to the Pantheon?
You know, I haven't. This is on my list of places to go.
It's so amazing. It's just something about it. When you walk in, you're at that base of the full circle contained in there, you know, and it's just odd.
So there's a spiritual aspect to that place is kind of where I'm headed. That it's rooted. It couldn't be anywhere else but where it is. The material, the quality of light.
Yeah,
these are poetic aspects of a building that is built with, you know, rigorous rules at the same time. So it's like anything of value. It's a combination.
Yeah.
It's an overlay.
Right. Yeah. It's one of the things that was so amazing to me about the Pantheon as well is that the streets have just through accumulation grown up around it by like 15 or 20 feet.
And
you see time translated into just mass coming up around something. It's amazing.
Right. Layers.
So layers and layers
happening.
So that kind of ties into the thing that you mentioned in what I read around theory and practice that you can get into practice, but you also intentionally practice theory to a large degree, that you take time to actually look into theory and not get too caught up in simply practice.
You know, when you're practicing, you know, there are serious practical matters to concern yourself with.
Yeah.
Architecture, and any any good design is solving many things at once, but it's solving all those things for human beings, right? So it's for your use, for the use of the people who will be in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this kind of idea is one voice in my head that kind of tests a design problem that's in the works, you know. Okay, this is working. The program is laying out in a way that makes sense on the site. We have, you know, the sun coming in to the kitchen in the morning. The kitchen has purview over the, you know, driveway.
Kind of objective data points, yes, to a degree that you're working with,
right,
there.
We've looked at the topography. You know, we've had a site survey done. We've marched around on site with flags and, you know, tape measures. And we have an understanding of we've interpreted that data in a certain way. But now, you know, what about the aspect that's going to elevate this to,
right,
to a different experience?
What's going to give it this X factor, mm-hmm, that you invest in time and experience on that side as a designer, and you try and translate your,
right,
your felt subjective experience into that built environment, along with translating what your clients are communicating to you as well.
And so we look to those things. We look to that kind of line of thinking to answer questions for us. Like, now that we have something solved to a point, what is this surface? How should it read? What's the texture? What's the color? What's the light going to be like at this time of day when it hits this wall? What should that wall feel like?
Mm-hmm.
And it begins to inform those, you know, because there's endless possibilities. So,
yep,
how do you answer those questions?
Mm-hmm.
And we look to the site to tell us,
right,
tell us the answers to those questions.
Now, are there fairly well-known differing philosophical approaches to creating something that looks like it should be there as opposed to something that looks like, yeah, I put this here and I did exactly what I wanted. Do you know,
mm-hmm,
what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this island in Casco Bay where someone just disregarded all,
mm-hmm,
everything, regulations and, mm-hmm, everything else. And there's all these massive red barns and huge, like, Greek columns. I don't know if you've, mm-hmm, been by that island or not.
I don't know it, but I hear what you're saying. You know, the two approaches. One is it something kind of looks like it grew right out of the site. And another,
mm-hmm,
one is a kind of counterpoint to the site.
Just imposed on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that can be done in such a way that it enhances what's on the site.
Kind of a complementary contrast or something.
Right. Right. I think of kind of the Villa Savoie, Le Corbusier's white house on Pilotis that sits in a green landscape. And it's a deliberate.
Right. Right. Separation from,
you know, it's deliberately saying this is man-made, this is nature, and they one sits on,
yeah,
the other delicately, and then one's white and the other is green.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a loud accident, you know.
Right.
Where it can be if not done thoughtfully, but,
right,
like in that instance, it's a beautiful contrast.
Right. So it doesn't have to, you know. This kind of site responsive design work, trying to find the spirit of the place, doesn't mean that it's going to be, you know, woodsy and brown and dark. You know,
mm-hmm,
it if you're on a wooded site, it might mean that you enhance that. Maybe you know, I'm thinking of a project that you photographed, you know, the site was kind of mossy and a little bit dark. And we decided to engage with that we decided to kind of root into that with board form concrete in one aspect, build right from the exposed ledge and lay these layers of board form concrete that kind of felt like it was growing right out of the ledge, you know, one aspect of the house. And the other aspect is galvanized steel columns that, you know, are very deliberately pinned to that ledge and are a counterpoint to it. So then the house sits on these columns and kind of floats above the site in addition to engaging with it.
We were just taking a walk in the woods yesterday with my kids, and we found this apple tree that was like this big around and had been burnt out in the middle. It looked like thing looked like it should be 200 years old, but there's a lot of just rolling ledge, very similar to that site that you're speaking of. And to me, it's always been nice in those situations to think about somehow just anchoring to those and spanning and letting the landscape just be very natural, but have kind of that pulled up and just floating above. Maybe it was your guys' project that shooting that, you know, really got me thinking more and more about that, to somehow span those distances, but just kind of be in it, but just a little above it and supported by it.
Yeah, there's sort of a, you know, different historic precedent, different cultures have done this in different ways. You know, this, what we're talking about, has a little bit of an Asian sort of, or Japanese kind of garden feel, where, you know, there's columns that sit on site. There's a long porch. And the relationship between site and building is a little bit separated, but they're linked in sensibility, but they're physically, one is set off the other. And what I love is, I mean, all of that is rooted in a purpose as well, you know, simple fact that wood wants to stay dry.
Right.
You know, so you hold it off the ground, you know, but in doing so, now you have an attitude about the site.
Right.
You know, and on the project we were talking about earlier, concrete doesn't care if it gets wet. So you can bring that right on top of the stone. And so there's a, you know, I think successful projects have a kind of marrying of these different aspects that we're talking about, where there's a, it serves a functional purpose doing what we're doing, and expresses a kind of poetic attitude about respecting the site, the nature, letting the nature flow right under the building, for example.
Now, I had read that you have been involved in some museums and such.
I have worked in museum projects, yeah.
Talk to me about working on projects of that scale compared to working as a residential architect.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to, working out west, I worked in Salt Lake City for a while.
Beautiful city, by the way. We went through there a few years ago.
It is, and it's a great city for, you know, having a real urban place really close to the Wasatch Front. The Rocky Mountains are right there. That's where the university is too. And we worked on the Utah Museum of Fine Art. Which is a project that was completed by or designed by Machado and Silvetti. They're out of Boston. And I worked for the firm that was the local architect, and we were commissioned to come back and do some addition, remodel kind of work there. But I love museums. Since I was a kid, I love that it's a different world. It's not the street or a house, you know. I mean, I would go on field trips. I grew up in Massachusetts. I would go on field trips to the Museum of Fine Art in Boston, or the Isabella Stewart Gardner. And, you know, it's sort of a temple for art. There's a quietness. There's a sense of respect, but it's a public place.
Reflective space as well.
Yeah, you know, you're there specifically seeking a certain kind of experience. You know, I love the Portland Museum of Art. here in Maine as well. And, you know, so scale matters, you know, on that kind of thing. But even in a large scale building, you're still looking for the human experience. You're still looking for the handrail on the grand stair that takes you to the second level. You're still wanting to engage somebody on a kind of tactile, personal level, mm-hmm. and take them through a space which might be, you know, grand and inspiring, but you're still right. looking for those opportunities.
Yeah, you're communicating a different how to be while you're in this space between a residence and a museum.
Right. I mean, a public building, too, is about seeing other people and being seen there mm-hmm. as a kind of citizen of this public space. You know, you're kind of, you might behave differently, you know, because you're on display and other people are on display.
Right.
So there's that aspect in a big public building, like a museum or a library. But, you know, a home serves different functions because there's sometimes when it's just you and your family there, or just you there.
Right.
And then there's the guest mode too.
Right.
And how does that work? And how does that change the atmosphere of a home when it's in that mode? You know, how does it change the atmosphere of a home when everybody's at home and when you're, you know, when your kids are home from school right. and you and your wife are working from home, you know, so that yeah. sort of tests,
yeah.
that kind of tests the house out in a different mode.
Are you guys all still working from home right now?
We are. Yeah. Yeah. And it's been a good, you know, I'm conscious of the fact that, this, you know, working from home experience is not equal for everybody. In my, you know, personal case, it's been a time to, you know, be with my family more often than I have ever. So it has a positive aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. I've work's obviously been a lot slower for me since March mm-hmm. and it's been really nice to have just more flexible time to just, you know, go on walks in the woods with right. my kids. And now that things are starting to, you know, ramp back up, there's definitely a little bit of a pit in my stomach, like, ah, man, it's going to get busy and I'm not going to, you know, be able to spend as much time. And, you know, and so the stress starts to come back in of like, all right, you got to start being productive and yeah,
right. busy. Yeah, it asks the question, you know, is there a way to kind of design is there a different approach to designing our lives now that we've seen this, this one way of living that it will inform things?
Yep.
I don't know.
So going back to museums and art, kind of not off topic question, but how do you experience and take in art when you go to a museum compared to seeing and experiencing art like in a residential setting or something else? Because I found that with my unique brain, not that I'm unique, but my experience, it's very difficult for me to absorb art and vision and meaning and everything of a piece of art. Unless I'm stuck in a place with nothing else to do other than to look at that. So in a museum, I can kind of control my pace and I just go through and I don't.
Right.
But what I have found is that in going like to marriage counseling and stuff, if they have a piece of art there, I start to see and experience because I'm digging deep and being reflective mm-hmm. in the conversation in that setting. And then there's this piece of art that visually I start to interact with and see meaning from myself in it and stuff. And it's interesting.
It is. And that's an aspect of museum design where, you know, it can be kind of overload. Mm-hmm. If you're going to a place that has, and you intend to see a whole museum in an afternoon, you know, you're kind of talking about pace, you know, you kind right. of, you know, sitting with, you know, they have benches, you know, sometimes, but sometimes it's crowded and you move on. But, you know, sitting and kind of dwelling with a particular piece of art, can be really rewarding.
Yeah.
You know, and then what I find too, I had this opportunity in October. We went to Spain as a family for a family trip. And with my daughters, we went to the Picasso Museum, you know, various Picasso works around. But it was, you know, sitting with them, asking them to sit there. We got there early in the morning. It really wasn't very crowded. Asking them to sit there, and you know, I'm the dad asking them, okay, can you guys sit here and maybe sit with this drawing, you know, this painting for a little while?
Yep.
And then gave them some paper and asked them to draw what they were looking at.
Oh, cool.
You know, so they're kind of drawing away. I've saved these drawings for us.
How long did they actually stay there?
They stayed there for a surprising amount of time. I think it was early, you know, we had just had some like nice, like, I don't know, baked goods on the way over or something, but we caught them at the right moment. Anyway, it's a memory that'll stick with me. And it caused me to see something different because they were there and because we were, you know, they were concentrating, I was concentrating, seeing this particular work. So you have to give it time, I guess.
For you, what does great art do for you?
You know, as an architect and as a, you know, someone who draws and kind of engages with it, you end up, you see something that's done in a particular way. And first is just sort of admiration or appreciation for, you know, what somebody's been able and skilled enough to create, you know? And that's sort of like the maybe kind of phase one, but, you know, the deeper you go into it, whether it's kind of a, I'll pick sort of Andrew Wyeth or some, you know, good artist with a local connection, you know, they're painting a whole world, you know, they're looking out a window into a whole world. And it's a moment in time. I mean, it can be a powerful experience if you kind of spend time with it. And it's a chance to kind of get out of your own way of seeing things.
Hmm. Yeah, the truly great and long lasting art seems to connect across the board.
Mm-hmm.
As it is something that someone has, to a degree, looked into the void and seen something in addition and has brought it back and has said, here it is. What do you guys think? And it's kind of like everyone's like, yep, we see it too. You know, there's that experience of the creative possessing openness as a personality trait, venturing into experience in the unknown, the chaos, if you will,
right,
and bringing something back in the form of art and articulating that in art and then handing it to the general population. And they say, wow, we see more now.
Right. They're going into the mine for us. Right.
Yeah.
They're kind of going and finding this something, bringing it out, putting it in front of us, a Rothko painting, something that's kind of abstract where you're kind of, you're just there in observation, but you see something of what the artist saw.
Right.
And that's about, again, not thinking as yourself. You're opening your perception to their perception, which is, you know, usually highly sensitive and highly specific.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me. I got to get away from that word because I just lead out with that every time. It's really interesting to me. But anyways, I find it fascinating. The peering into the chaos and the artistic personality is generally more sensitive, more volatile. But there's an ability through that to perceive more and to then return with something. And there's also a personality trait of openness that allows them to venture into the unknown and experience and bring that back. And there's a typically liberal personality type, and I'm not talking politically or anything else. They have, it branches out that way and will generally end up there. But as a personality type of someone who's more conservative, or mm-hmm. a personality type that's more liberal, a conservative will be more organized and will be more consistent and more reliable. And a liberal personality type will be more sensitive, more open to new experiences, and will find comfort and meaning from change and exploring chaos, where a conservative personality type will more so want to exist within the realm of the known and organize and manage that a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you had endless liberal personality types, nothing would get done. And we'd all be running into walls and around. And if we had all conservative, we'd never discover anything new potentially, right? Yeah. And so they're an extremely complementary marriage. It's as much as male and female.
Yeah.
A distribution of the personality types across the world is pretty much 50-50. And you see it actually when it translates into voting. You'll have just a very conservative base, a very liberal base, and there's very few there in between who actually kind of make the decision, the independence, right?
And I love the counter examples to that, to that division, you know. And this is, you know, part of what being an architect is for me, is reconciling that. You know, well,
it's demanded of an architect.
Yeah,
you have to bring that organizational and that experiential in. And that's, I think, why they call architecture one of the greatest art forms. I forget who that quote is and what exactly the quote is.
Yeah.
But yeah, that it's demanded.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Antoni Gaudí, okay, who, you know, again, because we were in Barcelona this last October, you know, here's a very devout soul, Gaudí, expressing himself in these fascinating, fantastic, rich forms, inventive architecturally, and it's a coming together of, you know, his mind is a kind of coming together of those two sensibilities, you know, and he's expressing it in a certain way. In religious art, you know, in Sagrada Familia, the big cathedral, you know,
that's still under construction.
Still under construction, a couple hundred years going, and it's beautiful,
it's
and
awesome.
Amazing. There's no other place like it. I mean, we were able to visit it. I was able to be there again with my daughter, you know, this is a kind of a place that represents to me that kind of marriage of being a seeker and asking questions.
Mm-hmm. All right. You said seekers, so I'll throw this one at you.
Sure.
there's a saying, I forget who came up with it first, but join those who are seeking the truth, flee from those who believe they found it.
Ah.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
I guess, you know, as an individual person, you know, if you're a curious person, then you'll find different sources of truth on your particular search.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I wouldn't flee from someone who's trying to answer my question, but their answer might not be a complete answer, and that's up to me to decide.
Yeah, my takeaway from that quote is that, you know, beware of the extremes.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, we see that in today, that, you know, a very extreme left viewpoint of nothing is true. You know, you just make your own meaning, you make your own everything. It's nothing, there is no truth, which in itself is a contradiction. And then, you know, the other direction you can go with that. So, yeah, it's Interesting. But as I was saying earlier, the where the artist goes out and brings something back, and then there's kind of the caretakers of our civilization, are the more conservative minded types. They guard what is known, you know, and they manage it and they organize it. And if that were not there, we would be in a huge amount of hurt. Conservative personality types play an immense role, and they protect and curate and maintain what is articulated knowledge, what is known. And it's as it should be that it is extremely difficult to find further truth that is accepted into the established articulated set of knowledge that we as a society maintain. And I struggled with that for a long time because I'm neither a leader nor a follower. I have a weird thing going on. And it seems like I'd perceive things and I'd try and run it against people that I know that are conservative, not against, but I'd run it past them, and they just constantly block. And and I realized at one point that's how it should be, that were you to just throw whatever you wanted into the articulated knowledge that we have as a society, that it would be absolute chaos everywhere. But there's that, there's a proximal zone of development where you can place yourself comfortably in the chaos and the unknown, and develop yourself while not overstressing yourself with the unknown. So you place yourself enough experientially into there where your personality fits for venturing there as much as possible, but also existing within the confines of what is known. You overdo it, you'll overdo it, you know, you underdo it, and you won't develop.
So to kind of ground, you know, again, I'm physically minded. So I'm going to ground what you're saying into a physical example for me,
right?
Which is a beautiful brick wall. Okay.
Which we have a lot
which
of.
You, there's a lot of
outside
beautiful inside. Brick walls here. Each brick is from the earth, is put into its forms and is put in different positions inside of a kiln. And is when the kiln's fired, the bricks come out redder or blacker or whatever color, depending on the mineral content of that soil or the earth. So every brick is individual and different. And so that represents a certain amount of chaos in the system. And yet these bricks can be organized into a running bond or some other bond. And built into a wall.
Now how horrible the brick walls are, where every single brick is 100% the same, like the new bricks.
That's right. Well, that's, and often those aren't, you know, those are veneer bricks, or they lack.
Exactly.
They lack that.
You know,
depth.
They're fake.
Yes. And they read, you know, wrong to you if you're sensitive to this, because they're not.
I'm cheering.
They didn't go through
now,
that process. They didn't go through that. That process. They don't have that individuality.
That,
you know, water struck brick
truth.
Is a, you know, traditional New England brick, you know, different sizes even, you know. So then it requires a mason to come in and work with those differences, you know, changing that head joint slightly, changing the bed joint slightly to make it work together. So I'm saying we need more masons in the world. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, to me, it strikes a real chord, because you look at that, you know, like fake veneer brick wall, everyone's exactly the same. And what my mind says is that doesn't reflect reality. That's not true. Not that it's a fake brick wall, that it's not true, but like every single one of those bricks shouldn't be exactly the same, just like us. Right. Like you project yourself into things. And if you're experiencing something that is that canned,
right,
that is that regimented, that is that perfect, you know, it's been an overreach of a controlling this, that, or the other that's produced a false reality that doesn't match truth.
It's sort of a non experience. It's sort of just, it's hard to engage with at all. It's sort of just a blank. This is a kind of a strip mall, you know, some kind of situation where that's what they put in.
Yeah.
Versus the buildings here that have texture and individuality in each brick.
Mm-hmm. That really it gives me a fizzy feeling inside. That's odd.
Uh-huh.
You know, the other thing that's fascinating rather than interesting,
mm-hmm.
When you even overlay this idea of conservative and liberal personality types that play a very, very appropriate role and are very needed in our lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't want to live in a single party country, in mm-hmm. my opinion. You want the poll this way and that way and the moderate middle to be achieved because yeah. of those. And you want a healthy landing in the middle. That's the safest place. You even look at that spiritually or mm-hmm. biblically, you'll mm-hmm. have priests
mm-hmm.
and prophets,
mm-hmm.
and they served those right. exactly different roles.
Yep.
And to me, that is a neat thing to see, and that, you know, you can overlay that into modern society where, you know, a priest is a type that maintains the order, that mm-hmm. that takes what's been accumulated, articulated knowledge, and, you know, serves the people with it.
Right.
But there's this whack job that goes out into the woods and eats locusts and is kind of weird, but comes back and the group says, wow, yeah, you actually got something there. We won't burn you at the stake. We'll allow that one in, you know?
Right.
And it's, yeah.
Yeah, there's sort of keepers of the law and there's, you know, seekers or finders of new law.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tension between the two,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of where we
dwell. That's where the beauty is. That's where the safety is in the tension between those. I think.
No, I mean, I think that tension is inevitable, and then we have to.
It's required.
Be comfortable, or find our way with, you know, in that tense position.
Right. Right.
This is where we exist.
I think to acknowledge that the tension is beneficial, needed, and were it not there, something would be going drastically wrong very soon,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think you can look at that with, you know, extreme socialist movements where they had maybe great intentions that they overthrew, you know, a crazy oligarchy or whatever in Russia, you know?
Right.
But then eventually with that, you know, like, all right, we're going to have the perfect brick wall. You know, mm-hmm. it's like we need a contrast pulling back and
right.
forth here to achieve reality.
I think part of this, you know, being comfortable in that tension is knowing that that's part of the design.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to be in tension.
Right. Right.
So that's not a problem. It shouldn't be pulled entirely one way or the other.
Exactly.
So, you know, the right side or the left side, neither one is entirely right or entirely wrong.
Hmm.
We exist in tension. So
right.
you know, we talk about the design of a system, like a form of government. If we're aware that that's how it's supposed to work,
right.
then maybe we can be comfortable with it.
Yeah, that's why. That's where I think the polarization right now
hmm.
is not beneficial thing. I think people
right.
need to realize, like, yeah, I gravitate this way and I see value in that as well. And we together, you know, we do this. And I think that's reflected in good design, that tension between the different poles and everything else, when you've balanced those tensions, beauty naturally comes out, I think, and it becomes efficient, it becomes lasting. Yeah, I think that's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Balancing order and chaos. I mean, I'm sure that's sort of a recipe for beauty.
Really. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I've got like still goosebumps. That was a really, I really appreciate your thought and take on that. It's a difficult thing to see and relate these, you know, very broad and in different parts of life, but be able to speak on them at where they intersect actually in design mm-hmm. and architecture and philosophy and spirituality and mm-hmm. everything else and see how they relate. See, I think that, you know one thing well, it can relate. You can know all things through knowing one thing well
mm-hmm.
and seeing like just the, the beauty in a well designed and executed joint in wood. Mm-hmm. Were that joint made too rigid and not to allow for the flexibility and everything else that is in it, that is inevitable, that right. joint fails and it's not right. beautiful. But that joint and seeing how it goes together and how it works with expansion and contraction and it lasts, you see that beauty of, you know, understanding reality and designing for it and creating that. And when you see that through philosophy and life and everything else, you really get an idea of, you know, wabi-sabi to a degree and all these other kind of ideas and philosophies around life and design that when you see it in one place, you see it in the other, and you start to perceive more. I think you get more understanding and you gain more peace from that. So mm-hmm. helps me understand myself and have less ulcers, maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
I hope so.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, again, I super appreciate that you came down today and that we finally got to have this conversation and really appreciate how your mind works and really look forward to reading your full article and everything else. And thanks again.
Thank you, Trent. I appreciate your thoughtful questions and just where your mind goes as well.
Left field.
Right.
All over the place.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, Trent.